This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, so let's dive right into our Week in Review. Big changes in the works this week. Boston City Councilors Michelle Wu and Anissa Asaibi George feel the heat as they try to change their title to mayor.
This is not what I wanted this mayoral race to turn into, and this is what I have tried to ensure that we stay focused on the issues.
Okay, we're going to hold it right here.
This is important work, Michelle, to lead this city, and the people of Boston deserve honesty. They deserve clarity.
Sound from a debate on NBC 10 earlier this week there. Families prepare for their kids to be safely vaccinated finally after 20 months of waiting.
We have secured vaccine supply to vaccinate every child ages 5 through 11.
I think this is a big win for the American people.
That's Jeff Zients, head of President Biden's COVID task force, and Dr. Ofer Levy, member of the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, speaking there. Meanwhile, acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey decides she has to change the city's approach at Mass and Cass.
Tents and temporary shelters will no longer be permitted in the city of Boston.
It's a big step, but the situation has become truly a humanitarian crisis.
I ran across a woman who comes down at least three times a week and just drops off food. She opens the back of her van and yells, "Food!"
WBUR's Deb Becker reporting to us there. We are going to review all of it, and let's start there at Mass and Cass with the situation around the neighborhood there. Did the acting mayor do the right thing for public safety, or will this criminalize homelessness and addiction? Will people want to go into treatment and shelter, and if not, what happens to them if the tents aren't allowed there anymore as long as there's a bed available? How do we get here? And should we have acted sooner? Should she have acted sooner? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Also here to join the conversation, Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and writer. Marie Frances, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
And Ed, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be back.
Okay, I'm going to start right away with some sound from acting Mayor Kim Janey unveiling her executive order, which, among other things, eliminates the tents and temporary shelters.
With a focus on public health, the executive order will establish a central coordinating team made up of city and state partners who will identify shelter and treatment options available through the region, as tents and temporary shelters will no longer be permitted in the city of Boston.
And I do want to clarify there, the mayor went on to say that one could not be forced from a tent if there wasn't a bed or a shelter place to go to. So I think that's a important caveat. But still, how do we even talk about this executive order, Ed and Marie Frances, without asking like 100 questions at once? Right thing, right time, enough, why now, what's next? What does it mean for the next mayor? Marie Frances, what is your reaction to this executive order?
I mean, it's heartbreaking what's happening down at Mass and Cass, has been happening for a long time. And bottom line is that everybody deserves safety, and safety is affordable housing. Safety is access to critical services. We see this happening in Boston. We see this happening across Massachusetts. We see it happening, frankly, across the country, and it's been worsened by COVID-19. And we have to come to terms with poverty. What we're seeing is poverty. And it's a human-made problem, and that these folks have been failed by our housing systems. They've been failed by our public health systems. They've been failed by our criminal legal systems. And we absolutely cannot, and we see faith leaders, public health experts say, we can't criminalize folks who are suffering from substance abuse disorders and don't have access to housing. So number one is, let's make sure that there are not any sweeps, because we've seen it happen before, right? And that we need to create a harm reduction plan that really centers the people who are experiencing homelessness down there, and to also have the money to be able to support city services and state-run services to help these people over the long term.
So, Ed, I'm going to play a little more sound here. As part of her executive order, Acting Mayor Janey's administration officially declared the situation a public health crisis.
Thus, the commission has declared substance use disorder, unsheltered homelessness, and related issues in the city of Boston a public health crisis.
As we think about that, Ed, we know there are a number of reasons that people don't want to go into shelter. If they go into shelter, then there are questions of their safe spaces, their belongings, whether or not they've been traumatized in spaces before, et cetera. So how is it going to work, this public health crisis, addressing this public health crisis by moving people out of tents without increasing trauma and potentially some criminalization, as Marie Francis said?
I think if you're addicted to opiates, you're never safe. Those tents on the street are not safe. But we keep hearing that there are treatment beds available and shelter beds available in greater number than the number of tents available there. We used to call it methadone mile to remind us why this happened, how we've institutionalized the problem rather than solving it, like Skid Row in L.A. or the downtown homeless problem in San Francisco. This is not working. The people that are living there are not getting better, and it's growing. It's a huge number of people. It's not improving. The logic that led to required vaccinations and masking needs to be applied to this public health crisis also, which is that individual autonomy is not as important as ending the human suffering, or at least reducing the human suffering. I agree. There's been failures in housing and treatment and many, many things, but this is not working. And I'm glad Mayor Janey is moving away from this, though it's not a coincidence she acted after she lost a preliminary election. Politics has been the problem with this issue for years.
So a couple things there. When, you know, part of the reason we don't call it methadone mile anymore, part of the reason that Skid Row isn't often the term used anymore, is to keep from pathologizing people who haven't had the supports that they need to work their way out of this. And Ed, I want to pick up on the second part of what you said, because both mayoral candidates this week had a response to this. And I want to play a little bit of Anissa Asaibi-George here, who said that not only does she approve of these moves, but they were her plan. So here she is at our town hall last night responding to me. I'm the one talking to her.
Day one of my administration, I can continue that work in a more meaningful way.
Do you think she literally picked up on your plan? And did you talk to her between when your plan came out on Sunday and when the acting mayor made her executive order on Tuesday?
Yes.
Which part?
All of it.
So then Boston mayoral candidate Michelle Wu also had positive comments about this earlier this week in the NBC 10 debate. She talks about hiring a cabinet-level official to deal specifically with the issue.
I stand in support of the leadership here to declare this a crisis in our communities, and I'm going to go even further. One of my first hires will be a cabinet-level chief of Mass and Cass, overseeing this new command structure and ensuring in reporting directly to me that there's accountability and leadership in coordinating our efforts.
So, Marie Francis, I wanted to get both of those voices in because it does raise a question. It was exactly 2 weeks before a mayoral election when Mayor Janey did this, but this has been a problem for a long time. 2 weeks after that election, there will be a new mayor. So why does acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey do this 4 weeks before someone else will be in charge? What do you think is going on there?
Firstly, winter's coming. It's going to be cold soon, so it just makes sense to try and figure out a plan that is people-centered. And, you know, and it's important to bring up the conversation now. I mean, voters have, what, less than 2 weeks to make a decision on who they're going to vote for to be the next mayor of Boston. And I think it's an important time to elevate this issue.
So I want to think about one other part of this, too. And again, we've just had a lot of amazing sound this week from this story. Here is WBUR's Deb Becker, who did some reporting from Mass and Cass on the day after the executive order. And she talked with us about a chilling scene that she witnessed while walking the neighborhood with an activist.
You know, we came across a woman who was it was awful. I mean, she was passed out on the sidewalk and didn't appear to be breathing well, and he was trying to help her. He did get her upright, and she became very agitated and told him to leave her alone, and she eventually just walked away. And I don't know what happened to her.
So, Ed, that is the opposite of the bystander who ignores what they see, right? This activist tried to do something. And I think about the scale of this problem, the fact that we know for a fact many of the people who have found themselves there come from other parts of the Commonwealth, where we're not seeing coordinated response and where we're seeing pushback as the city of Boston tries to get a regional coordinated response. How do you get past that pushback? And I guess, you know, is there a role for the governor to play in this?
It comes down to incentives. The reason why people are traveling great distances to get there is because they know that there are incentives there that are not available elsewhere. I don't think this is about the number of treatment programs that are available. They've realized they can go somewhere and stay there and not face the hard choices. You know, I think I'm not pathologizing people that are there that suffer from addiction. It's a medical condition. It's what are we doing? You know, a lot of people, I'm one of them, have had people in our lives over the years that had addictions and mental illness, and we ended up enabling it year after year when we really should have stopped enabling it and really made them make decisions. I think the city and the state have to decide to stop enabling what is happening there in the name of compassion, in the name of how these people are suffering. Something special is happening there that is sucking people in, and we have to change the incentives of going there. I do think it's regional. It's not about the city of Boston entirely. The state should get involved. I assume the state is involved in some way, but ultimately it's Mayor Janey's call to decide how she's going to manage the on-the-street situation. Even the people feeding them, I believe in feeding the poor. But again, these people are all enabling them to stay there by giving them what they need, and they're not getting better. I think there are hard choices to be made, and I want to see Mayor Janey and then Michelle Wu make those choices.
So Ed has put a stake in the ground about who he thinks is going to win, I think, there in the mayoral election. We only have a little bit of time left before I want to take a quick break and shift gears, Marie Francis. But I do want to ask pointedly the responsibility of Quincy in this, because they are the key to a Long Island bridge that could restore services on Long Island.
Yes, I agree with Ed on one point, is that elected leaders, and whether it's city and town officials or on the state level, need to do something. One thing that really stuck with me as I was, you know, looking at all the coverage and listening to the stories on this is people saying that whether it's in Quincy, whether it's in Everett, where there were plans to perhaps have some housing in Everett, the services are, you know, and I'm quoting somebody on this, are grossly underfunded. So we need to put our money where our mouths are as well in terms of making sure that folks have stable and supportive housing and services that they need.
So I think you might be talking about Revere and that proposal for the 35.
Yes.
Yeah, Quality Inn and Revere.
Me.
No,
Revere.
That's fine. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to still with us Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and writer, and Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. Join the conversation. We want to know, are you boosted? Are you going to get boosted? Are you doing the mix and match now? Maybe you're not yet vaccinated. Why? Ready to move on from the whole thing? And a little bit later, with an election a little more than a week away, are you voting in your city and town? Election day? Early? Undecided still? We'll talk about all of it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ed, how big of a deal is it for our public health to have the level of booster rollout that we are at now? Just to be clear, all three brands qualify for a booster with certain populations. With J&J, everyone over 18 who got it more than 2 months ago. Now mixing and matching allowed. Did you ever think we'd get here?
Yes, I was confident that boosters would be necessary at some point. It's welcome, though, because it hopefully will smooth out our exit from COVID as the size of the public health threat that it poses. I do feel that the rest of the world needs to get vaccinated, and I wonder how many Americans will get a shot when there are more needy arms in the developing world. So I do have qualms about that, but I do hope that those who are vulnerable, who need a booster shot, actually get it. And I hope that those who don't need it maybe don't get it in favor of someone else getting it.
So there's another thing that's been on my mind, Marie Francis, which is sort of self-inflicted wounds in the public health messaging. Here's an example. So first, the J&J vaccine, it's get it. And they're all just as good. Then it's, well, the most important thing is to get a vaccine. So if that's the one available, get it. Then, well, maybe it should have been two doses. It's a little less effective. Then every single person who got it needs another shot after at least 2 months. And then, in fact, you're probably better off getting a different shot, right? So is that unavoidable given the rapid changing nature of this pandemic? Or are those self-inflicted wounds that confuse and frustrate people in public health messaging?
So, I mean, I think we've been in this uncertainty for, feels like eons at this point, but almost 2 years. And, you know, I think the message is clear. Number one, you should be vaccinated. Also the messaging follow up, and similar to what Ed said, is walk, don't run to get a booster shot. So I think we also have to give some grace to you know, the public health experts who are all trying to figure this out in real time. But I'm hopeful and I'm excited about the potential vaccine rollout for young folks.
So actually, all right, let's talk a little bit about that. So here is Jeff Zients, head of President Biden's COVID task force, says the federal government has 28 million doses ready to go as soon as vaccines for children age 5 to 11 are authorized.
We have secured vaccine supply to vaccinate every child ages 5 through 11. And as soon as the vaccine is authorized by the FDA, we will begin shipping millions of doses nationwide.
So, Ed, to your point a minute ago, and I've been thinking also a lot about this, we have 28 million doses ready ahead of time on something that 20 months ago, well, we know from previous interviews that about 22 months ago, they were just beginning to sequence this thing, right? And now we are ready to vaccinate one of the last remaining groups of people who hadn't yet qualified. I wonder sometimes, too, if we're not taking enough time to marvel at the sheer will and innovation that has gotten us to this part of this pandemic.
We haven't, but it's hard to marvel during a pandemic. But you are absolutely correct that the idea of getting a vaccine out this fast is historically unprecedented. People would have said it was impossible even 4 or 5 years ago that this could be done. So I think that if, as you had implied, that if this was the traditional vaccine rollout, none of these problems would happen because people could have waited for the data. I still think it's miraculous. I continue to think it's miraculous, and I'm trying not to be impatient based on how they've done it. But I'm very much looking forward to the 5 to 11 rollout, as I have three of my children are 5 to 11, so I'm looking forward to that.
You'll be in line?
We'll all be in line, yes.
Fantastic. All right, I wanted to grab a couple of calls here. First is Tom in Acton. Tom, go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead, Tom. Hi.
Just kind of giving a perspective, I got my booster, but I would also highly recommend everybody else get their own boosters. I work in the hospital, and we actually having difficulty shipping, taking care of patients in the ICU because numbers are so high that we actually have to get to the point where we have to ship patients out of state because all the patients in the ICU, anyone who has COVID, are usually the people who are not vaccinated. So that was just...
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that perspective, Tom. And I do want to pick up Paul in Marshfield as well. Paul, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I got my Johnson & Johnson in April 7th of this year, but I'm wondering with the new information, can I just go to Walgreens and get like a two-shot thing of Moderna?
So this is not Ask the Doctors, Paul, but because yours was April 7th, I got the Johnson & Johnson on April 10th, as it happens. So we are kindred spirits in this. The new guidance does allow for you to get a Moderna or Pfizer booster. As I understand it, and this is as I understand it, it will not be a two-shot course. It is a single shot of one of the mRNAs, but the CDC has allowed for anybody after 2 months of the J&J shot over the age of 18, it does allow you to get an mRNA, which is Moderna or Pfizer booster. All right, so actually, there's a lot I want to make sure that we get to. We've done a little bit of COVID here. We've done the boosters. We've done the kids. I do want to spend a minute on the mayor's race. And Marie Francis, I'm going to note something that was interesting. We did these two town halls this week at WBUR with counselors Anissa Asaibi-George and Michelle Wu. In fact, we're going to have an excerpt from Asaibi-George later in the show. We took audience questions. We got some 40 questions per town hall submitted. Some of them were duplicates. But what struck me was in all of that, there was one question about COVID, Marie Francis, which would have boggled the mind 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. Is the city of Boston looking forward now in this mayor's race?
I think it is. I mean, firstly, we want to commend just the tremendous efforts that councilors Anissa Asaibi-George and Michelle Wu to try to represent this beautiful and diverse city. That's interesting that you only got one question about COVID. I sometimes think it's such part of our lives that sometimes we forget it exists until it's really in our faces again. But I mean, I just commend also what you've done, what WBUR has done. I think part of the richness of this race and has been just the conversations that we've had, the community forums, the televised forums, and all of the connections that we've made throughout many, many months together. And that in and of itself has just been pretty transformational.
I want to pick up on that. I had some different sound I was going to play, but I want to pick up on that, Marie Frances, because I recall a moment on Monday night talking with Michelle Wu where she talked about the many, many, many public forums that all of the candidates participated in. And you could hear, Ed, both the fatigue in her voice and kind of the awe and respect of the fact that there's been that much public conversation. And then we heard Anissa Asaibi-George last night talk over and over again about the importance of being in dialogue with the voters in the city. So I guess my question to you, Ed, is have we seen a different approach with these candidates? And is there a dialogue on the issues going on with community leaders, with voters, with people on the street that feels different?
Well, I mean, the race isn't competitive at all. I mean, Michelle Wu has been up by 30 points or more in among polling shops that don't make those kinds of mistakes. So she'll be mayor no matter what happens. But I do think that the debate has been good. A lot of forums, great coverage, media organizations looking for the issues, listening to various communities, all different aspects of the candidates and their lives. I think it has been really great, the debate. I think it's very, very good to the city. I don't think these two women would be very different as mayor. I do think the debate has been great.
So I also want to pick up on that, Ed. So now I am going to play two pieces of sound. First, Michelle Wu from the second mayoral debate responding to Anissa Asaibi-George's claim that Wu is copying ideas from her campaign, amongst some other claims.
The city of Boston deserves better. Our country and our democracy barely survived 4 years of Trump and the types of campaigning that involve negative attacks, personal attacks, falsehoods, and fear-mongering. This is not what I wanted this mayoral race to turn into, and this is what I have tried to ensure that we stay focused on the issues.
And then last night, I want to put next to that Anissa Asaibi-George, a final question that I asked her, what is in your heart?
The city is in my heart. The city's people are in my heart. The city's kids are in my heart. And I worry about them, and I want to do this work for them. I want to lead this city in partnership with them every single day.
So, Marie Frances, two edges of a blade there. One, two candidates speaking passionately about what they think the city deserves. And two, a hint of the fight that has emerged between two candidates that many have said are not that different in policy positions. Is that just what I've read a race forces? Is that daylight? And your comments on those?
Well, I feel like this is the beauty of female leadership, that we want to be in dialogue with people. We want to be part of the community and be a leader with the community. I don't agree that how they would run the city or their policy positions are the same. They, in my estimation, are quite different in terms of public safety, in terms of modernizing our infrastructure.
And we should note, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Yes. I should have noted that you personally are supporting Wu in the race.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. But in terms of the plans, if you look at them black and white, there are differences there. So we shouldn't, sweep that under the rug. But yes, I think it's been a pretty stand-up race for the most part, and it's getting down to the wire, and it's typical as a political race comes so close that there, are some words exchanged. So,
and Ed, you've made it pretty clear where you think this is going to come out. Just very briefly, because, well, you know what? Actually, I want to move us on to our hubbubs here, and I'm not supposed to do that, right? It's not good hosting to start the middle of a sentence on a subject and say, I am going to change a subject in the middle of my sentence. But I get to do that. And we have some fun hubbubs today. So actually, let's call it there. We're going to do more again on the mayoral race after the break. Let's do those hubbubs. And Marie Frances, I was just talking to you, so you go.
I'm very excited. The Boston Globe just started the Black News Hour. It's run by Black journalists. Janae Osterhelt and Megan Irons are, I think, the two leading hosts. And it's just looking into, expanding the dialogue on issues in the Black community here in Boston.
Two fantastic minds, both people that we have sometimes here on Radio Boston. Great hubbub. Thank you. Ed, you brought one, too.
Yes, so it came out a couple of days ago that our Massachusetts Department of Transportation, looking at traffic patterns, has noticed that a lot of drivers are shifting to a Tuesday to Thursday in-person work week, and traffic is much different on the middle of the week than it is on Mondays and Fridays. I drove into the city this morning and there was almost no traffic. I think it's fascinating to discover that maybe the post-COVID world will have a very different commuting schedule. And I think that will really alter people's lives if that sticks. I thought that was fascinating.
I actually think it is fascinating. Rarely do we get to sort of see a social experiment play out because of exogenous conditions, Ed. And it is interesting to now see sort of what we would have wondered and had no way to know. And obviously, we had an awful way to find out. But it is fascinating to see that now. Okay, so my hubbub. We cannot go into Friday without a moment to acknowledge what in the sports world is known as the thrill of victory.
Schwarber hits it a ton into right. At the wall. Another grand slam.
And then the agony of defeat.
And now Jason Castro, the Astros' final hope here in the top of the ninth. And that's lifted in the short right center for a base hit. Correa around third. He will score. Gurriel on his way to third. He's in safely. Jason Castro comes through.
Oh, my God. I hate that so much. So a painful week of ups and downs in the American League Championship Series. Sox versus Astros. The Sox win two huge games and then are just dusted by the Astros twice, sound there from games 3 and 4. So listen, game 6 is in Houston tonight, and either the Sox win or they are done for the season. Game time is 8:08 p.m. It will be an interesting one to watch, and don't lose hope because Nathan Eovaldi pitches for the Sox tonight, and he has shown up when necessary. So it should be a lot of fun. All right, that is everybody's hubbubs. Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, thank you for being with us this week.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and writer. Great to have you as always. Thanks, Ed.
You're welcome.